Welcome to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast,
your source for everything outdoors.
Let's kick it into overdrive.
Overdrive Outdoors Podcast, brought to you by Predator Hunter Outdoors. Whether you are new to predator hunting or looking to upgrade your equipment, Predator Hunter Outdoors will have you hunting after the sun goes down. Carrying a full line of lights, night vision, and thermal optics, along with tripods, calls, mounting systems, and more, check them out at www.predatorhunteroutdoors.com or on Facebook at Predator Hunter Outdoors. Use promo code OVERDRIVE2021 for 20% off your order. Want to lengthen your time in the field and shorten your scouting time? Not only does the HuntWise app show you property boundaries, landowners' names, and in some cases even their phone number, but using the app will show you the wind direction on the map of the place you want to hunt. And the HuntCast feature shows peak movement times for various species, including predators. Get the HuntWise app at www.huntwise.com, the Google Play Store, or the Apple App Store. For only $59.99 a year for Pro or $119.99 a year for Elite. Use promo code OVERDRIVE20 for 20% off an annual membership.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Overdrive Outdoors Podcast. This week is going to be hosted by Kevin Rott, and he's going to be joined by J.D. Pyatt of IcoTech Game Calls. J.D. gives us some information on what he does with IcoTech, how he came to work with IcoTech, and things he had done prior to starting predator hunting. JD and Kevin are going to get into some coyote hunting tactics, including situational tactics, seasonal tactics. And one thing I picked up for sure is that JD says he really doesn't change his technique much throughout the year. If something's working, he plays it, and if it's not working, he changes it up. In JD's words, it's a lot like fishing. I think y'all are going to enjoy this episode, so sit back, relax, hit play. Thank you once again for clicking download. We appreciate it very much. Without further ado, let's get into it with Kevin and J.D. Pyatt.
Hey, everybody. This is Kevin with Overdrive Outdoors. Thank you for joining the podcast. Tonight, we have special guest J.D. Pyatt, right? Did I pronounce that right? Pyatt.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. JD Pyatt. Sorry about that.
No problem.
With us from Ohio. JD works with IcoTech, correct?
Yes, sir.
And you're running a show/business called Predator Academy, right?
Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay. On YouTube.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I've watched several of those episodes. It's been good stuff so far. You've got what, like four or five episodes out now?
I think we're going on seven now.
Oh, seven. Okay.
Getting ready to do seven. I do the editing for it. So,
so a little bit of background, tell us how you got started in predator hunting or hunting in general for that matter.
Well, with predator hunting in general, you know, it started out as a Thanksgiving tradition when I was a kid. Every Thanksgiving, you know, all the guys were going pheasant and rabbit hunting. So that's what got it all started. And then led to squirrel hunting. And then fox, because fox were a challenge. And I liked the challenge. So the first calling I actually started doing was fox, because we didn't have coyotes in Ohio at the time.
What year was that roughly? I mean, time frame was that?
It had been about 82.
Okay.
Because I'd been about 12 to 14 years old. So when I originally started, you know, had the proper equipment, a red light and a tape recorder with a cassette and all that fun stuff, and a shotgun with some, what did we shoot? At the time, everybody kept feeding me, I think it was double-aught buck, which was the worst thing you could be shooting in my eyes for predators at night. You know, right. you're cutting your shot down. You might have double aught, but you've only got nine of them in there versus, you know, a big pile of number four buck or something. Right. So, but yeah, I was, intrigued with the challenge of predators. And I mean, it was so bad, Kevin, when I was eighth grade, which I don't know, I can't remember what year that was, but that was my science fair project.
Really?
The red and the gray fox. Yeah. Oh,
very cool.
Yeah. I've always been intrigued by predators. So that was my science fair project. And then, you know, once the coyotes started moving in, I was also a trapper. I trapped, you know, as much as I hunted and called as well.
Did you trap both land and water animals?
You know, I really didn't do much with water because it wasn't much of a challenge.
Okay.
Because, you know, it was find a run and stick a trap in the run and hope there'd be a muskrat or mink the next morning. With predators, you know, trapping fox, it was trying to get them to step on a 2-inch circle, you know, and make that catch. And there was an art to it, you know, with the dirt hole set and the lures and trap placement and location. And so that challenge is what's always driven me when it comes to predators.
And back then you could get decent money for fox fur, right?
Oh yeah. 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 When I was young and first got into it, you know, red fox would bring $70-$75 for good cherry. Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Gray fox, I think, was around 50 to 55. So, and a raccoon even. I remember, you know, at the start, I'd take a raccoon into a fur buyer and throw him on the floor, not even, you know, skin, nothing, and walk out with $30-$35 check. So,
and for a kid in school, that's darn good money.
That's darn good money. Yeah. Yeah. That helped me, you know, build up my trapping collection or my supplies and all that, but it didn't last long.
Yeah.
You know, mid-80s, the fur industry took a major hit.
Right.
So I got in right at the end. But
so did you start deer hunting later then? I mean, I see that obviously this is just audio, but I can see all the deer on your wall back there. And I know you've posted pictures of them before. You've been doing really well with deer. So did you start deer hunting after predators, or was that before predators?
Actually after, you know, first thing was trapping and then the rabbits and all that, you know, that kind of stuff. But my first deer I shot when I was 16. And that was during gun season, here in Ohio. And then, I've been hunting ever since. And then, you know, the challenge again, bow hunting's a passion of mine as well.
Mm-hmm.
So, I've fortunately taken quite a few bucks over the years, but with bows.
Okay. So you mentioned earlier that there weren't a lot of coyotes in Ohio back when you were younger. About what time frame would you say you started actually seeing them on a regular basis?
It probably would have been, I would say on a regular basis, late 80s, early 90s.
Okay.
I mean, if thinking back, I mean, it's been a few years ago, but I know I was ate up with calling and learning how to call and kill coyotes, you know, right out of high school.
Okay.
So that'd been 89-ish, 90s, early 90s.
Okay.
You know, that almost took precedent over girls at the time, you know, and partying.
It's a toss up as to which is more expensive, though.
Yeah. Nowadays, no kidding.
Right?
Yeah. Women are cheaper nowadays than the thermal in the nighttime coyote game.
Right. So, speaking of which, when you first got into predator hunting, I'm assuming you probably started off doing most of it in the daylight.
Actually, no, at night.
Really?
With, you know, lights and just a. Basically how it started was, you know, I'm out fox calling and I've seen, you know, when I first started, the gray fox numbers were high in Ohio, so I was killing gray fox. Red fox were the challenge because they were in open country, and you know, I always stuck to wood and timber and whatnot or right on the edges for the gray fox.
Mm-hmm.
The gray fox population started dwindling away, whether it was sickness or what, I don't know, but So I started moving out in the open, targeting red fox, and then slowly started calling coyotes at the same time at night with red lights. And there was, I could tell the difference because a red fox coming to the caller at night with red lights would look at the sound source as it's approaching it. And most of the time they would do a downwind slide, just like a coyote will. The coyote will do it a little further out, but they would look at the sound source the whole time they were working the wind approaching that caller. Whereas the coyote would look only when he was stationary, meaning stopped. Every time he'd start moving, he'd look away, like he'd look straight the way he's moving. And I would lose him all the time. And I couldn't kill him. You know, I moved from a shotgun then to a 222 at the time, with the red light attached on the scope, you know, trying to kill them, but they didn't look. They wouldn't stand still long enough. I mean, I struggled, and I was educating them. And at that point, you know, I decided the more I read and seen in books and every video I could get my hands on, daytime was the time to be doing it for the coyotes. And that's when I, you know, gave up all the lights, all that stuff, and went strictly daytime and did that for 20 years or so.
Oh, wow.
Daytime. Yeah. And that was a challenge.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, you got to be a bullheaded, driven to continue. I mean, I went through a lot of guys in my time that wanted to go and wanted to hunt with me and all that. And we'd hunt all weekend, damn near daylight to dark, not see a coyote. And they didn't want to go again next weekend, most of them.
Right.
So.
So then, as you transition from daylight, I know you've gotten back into night hunting. Did you go back to lights then, or did you jump right into night vision or thermal?
Well, what got me back into nighttime was Don Schumacher.
Yep.
We did a show with Icotech over in Virginia. Don was from Virginia. He sent me home with an AR with a Gen 3 night vision scope on it.
Oh, very cool.
And a FLIR handheld thermal monocular. He said, go out and give this a try. See what you think, you know, no lights. Because it got, you know, to the point, I just didn't want to do it because it was so hard to kill them and just educate them. So anyhow, I went out with that stuff. And of course, the learning curve, I missed 4 or 5 coyotes that I called in. The hell, I ended up killing like 7 or 8 coyotes in a month's time with that stuff. And Don wanted his gun and his thermal back. So ended up getting that stuff back to him after a couple months of trying it out and then going to red lights. And, you know, we called coyotes and was able to kill them with red lights then because the lights were a heck of a lot better now versus 20 years ago. Right. So I was able to see them, whether they were looking at me or not, with a day scope and a high powered red light. So, but it was still, you know, a challenge for sure. And then going to night vision was a night and day difference. And then going to thermal from night vision is another night and day difference. You know, it's just making the odds that much better for us, the hunter.
And since you mentioned him, Don Schumacher has a couple of really good books out on coyote hunting for our listeners here. I actually think my copy is out on loan right now, but the one that I have is Journals of a Coyotero, correct?
Yep.
And he recently passed away, which is unfortunate, but I know he talked about you in his book and he talked about a few others, but for anyone that wants to read about coyote hunting and a lot of detailed information from back in the old days up until more recent times, it's a really good book. If you can find one, get a copy of it.
Yeah, sure is.
So when did you get involved with Icotech?
That would have been 2014. I had got started with that as I've always videoed hunts. daytime coyote hunts, deer hunts, turkey hunts, and been involved with several TV shows through the years.
What TV?
Outdoor Insights, which was an Ohio-based show. Widowmakers TV, which was mostly deer. What else? Scentlock's High Places was some deer stuff. But that, having my name out there that way, plus in 2008, got into the World Predator Expo out in Kansas City and ended up winning a world title in coyote vocalization stage calling.
Oh, really?
So that helped. Cool. Yeah, that helped put my name out. So they contacted me, Chuck from Icotech, and wanted to know if I would try one of their callers. You know, he told me a little brief description of how they got started, where they'd been at prior. And yeah, from that one phone call to led into a full-time working, you know, in the predator industry now.
Nice.
So, which my coyotes are out there howling now. I don't know if you can hear them.
Just a little bit. Yep.
Can you?
Yep.
Yeah. So I raised coyotes. So.
When you won that competition, what calls were you using? Hand calls or diaphragms?
I used a Reese Outdoors little close read call for like my rabbit distress and a fawn distress that I got called upon. The howler that I used was a Elk Inc. power howler.
Okay.
And that thing is, yeah, it's, I know everybody likes to use the diaphragms now, but personally, I've tried them both and I don't think you can beat a power howler, but that's me. That's my personal opinion.
So then you said you originally started off using some of the old cassette tape callers. Were you using hand calls at that time too, or is that something you started doing later?
Actually, for the fox and stuff, it was tapes. Johnny Stewart's Gray Fox Pup. I mean, that tape probably has killed more fox in the country than anything else. Yellowhammer, that was a woodpecker, and then Johnny Stewart's Cottontail. Those three tapes I had. And then it moved into the Johnny Stewart, can't remember which model that was, had the speaker and a cord and the little changing cards. Mm-hmm. Praymaster. It was a Praymaster, I think's what it was. Used that for a while, and then mixed in hand calls. You know, it took me a while to learn them.
Would you say overall a lot of what you've been doing has been self-taught then, or did you have a mentor that helped coach you on some of this stuff?
Nobody locally. There was nobody that I could, you know, go to and go with and learn from. It was all, I had an old man and that was a trapper, and he got the Trapper Predator Caller magazines when they were the big full size, like a newspaper, you know?
Yep.
Well, he would bring them to me and drop them off at my house all the time. So most everything I learned was from reading. Okay. You know, from guys like Jerry Blair and reading Johnny Stewart stuff in those magazines. So, and then going out and trial and error and learn.
That makes for a longer learning curve, but I tell you what, I think you learn a lot.
Hell yeah. You learn from a lot more
what not to do.
Yeah, get mistakes.
Right.
Yeah.
So what exactly do you do for Icotech right now?
I handle customer service and support, and then I do the audio recordings and editing of those. What else do I do? Photography, hunting and killing coyotes, help with sales, help manage pro staff, a little bit of everything. Okay. You know, repair callers, any caller that has an issue, you know, gets sent to me, and I do repairs on them.
Very cool.
So, and then help design collars and that kind of stuff as well, and test them.
So we touched on it a little bit earlier, and then you just went back to it talking about your coyotes howling back there. So a lot of, you said you handle a lot of the sound files for those collars as well. You've made them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A lot of the stuff in our library that's labeled ICO or JDP, I've pretty much recorded. Not 100%. There's some that's, you know, we've worked some deals. Somebody got a recording and offered it to us and made a trade or bought it or whatnot. But the majority of them I've recorded.
That's very cool. Especially, you know, that's one thing. We did a podcast a while back with Tony Tebby talking about, you know, how much he's learned from the coyotes that he has out there. Do you have anything in particular that stands out that you've learned from having coyotes at your house?
They're not as smart as I always gave them credit for.
Really?
Yeah. They just live by fear in their stomach. As far as, you know, I've done a lot of talking with people, and people ask me about a correlation between these coyotes and wild coyotes. Mm-hmm. So say, you know, on a day these guys are active or vocal, which they're usually not vocal unless they are something triggers them to be vocal. They don't just howl to howl, mm-hmm. put it that way. And there's no correlation. I cannot. You know, I thought there would be. I thought, because I've seen days where they won't even come out of the shed and come outside. And then there's other days, you know, they're outside and they're active, they're romping and doing their thing. And I thought, well, okay, you know, I'm going to hunt on these nights and see if the wild ones are active. There was just no correlation. So I've never really been able to learn anything off of these that is helps me in the wild.
Okay.
Other than recording their sounds, they kill right. They kill the wild ones with the noises they make. So
I'm assuming that each one kind of has a little bit different of a voice, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Now, do you notice, other than the voice, is there much difference in how they vocalize?
Luna's definitely the boss. You know, if she doesn't speak, nobody speaks. When she speaks, they all speak.
Is she the oldest?
No, she's been that way ever since she's been a tiny little pup.
Okay.
She is the boss. And everybody knows it. Yeah. So, that, I guess, seeing how they, you know, are structured in that pack is kind of neat. I can't use any of it to help me with killing wild coyotes though, but it's kind of neat in that, you know, seeing that structure that they have.
I'm assuming you live outside of town a bit. So have you ever had any times where, let's say, a wild coyote came to check out yours?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, it was yesterday. I was out cleaning up, walking around, and there's coyote tracks within 10 feet of the kennel. So really? they've the wild ones have come around. Mm-hmm. Usually, you know, I'll know when there's one close because they're going nuts. And then if I come outside, you know, there'd be a coyote. I live a quarter mile off the road and with no neighbors right next to me, which is nice, but yeah, there'll be a coyote in the front hay field or in the woods on the other side of the house, just, you know, running his mouth and getting these guys all worked up, fired up. And then that doesn't happen as often as I thought it would, but mm-hmm. you know, maybe once a month one will come around, get close, and gets loud.
You notice more of that around breeding season, or do you don't think they getting interaction?
No, I haven't seen anything like that. No, which, from what, if I wouldn't have coyotes, I would think that, mm-hmm. but with the way they are territorial and defend their turf and kill, people's pets, dogs. Cats are food, but dogs are a threat to them, so they'll kill them, because of that threat. But no, I've not seen, anything out of the ordinary with having the coyotes here.
You mentioned earlier that one of your first rifles was a 222.
Yeah.
Well, that's one you don't hear about too much anymore.
No.
Still got it?
No, I don't. I gave it to my son.
Okay.
But I shot several coyotes and watched them spin and flop and get up and run off. And I knew his gun's just not quite big enough.
What's your preferred firearms to use now?
I like 22-250, but that's my daytime gun. My nighttime gun's a 22 Nosler.
Okay.
Because I like the AR-15 platform. I'm 52 years old now, and AR-10s are for the young guys. Big tree trunks, so I like the shorter framed, lighter framed AR-15, and the 22 Nosler's about the caliber for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
So tell us about Predator Academy.
Predator Academy is an online show that I'm doing with Jeff Turner. He's down around Dayton. The reason I'm doing Predator Academy is to try and help people shorten that learning curve. I don't know how to put it. I guess it's becoming so popular now, calling is, that we're all seeing it with, competition and educated coyotes and hard to kill coyotes. I mean, thermal is a major game changer, and it's put success in a lot of people's hands quick. But still, they're getting educated and making my job that much harder yet. Yep. To continually kill. Right. So if I can help those people learn quicker and kill the ones that they're calling in, we're all going to benefit, I think, from it in the long run.
I couldn't agree anymore.
Yeah. Educated coyotes are hard to kill, if killable at all, without, just flat out murdering them, whether it's just sniping them with the, but so that's, the way I look at it anymore is, I used to be kind of secretive with what I did, and I don't need to do that anymore. Everybody knows I can kill a coyote if I have to. And now it's, all right, let's shorten that learning curve for you. That way we're all killing coyotes, and the ones that are left are not as educated. So.
Yeah, I agree with that completely. We've talked about that a lot lately, on our podcast here. That's why we've been having people on like yourself, people that know more or have more experience than we do. Because same thing, we want to help people be successful, so there's less educated ones out there and people are doing good at it. I know when I first got into it, my sources of information were, like you said, magazines. There weren't a whole lot of books that I remember. YouTube wasn't around then, so it was like magazines and online forums. I was lucky enough to have a guy that did take me under his wing, and he taught me a lot about it. But other than that, I like Josh talks about too, I want to say it was 2-3-4 years before I successfully called in a coyote. And even after that first one, it took me another year or two before I could start doing a consistent level. And, like you said, you're educating a lot of them. You're out there trying your hardest, but you said there's so many people out there trying to do it now, and thermal makes it seem like it's an easy game, and it does help, but it's like when we had tournaments here in Michigan, there were several organizers that actually wanted to ban the use of thermals for tournaments. And we argued that, you know, we didn't think that was fair. Yes, thermal helps, but you still have to be able to call them in.
Right.
If you can't call them in, you might get lucky, like you said, occasional snipe one, murder it, what have you, but you still got to call them in to be able to, you know, be successful. So they never did ban them that I remember for any events, even though they talked about it. But yeah, I just think that, you know, overall, if we can shorten that learning curve and help people be successful right off the bat or closer to it, like you said, there's going to be fewer educated ones out there, and hopefully it's better for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah. I totally agree. And then I've got a philosophy, I think, going beyond that as well, with the way things are slowing down, like where I'm at locally. And, you know, I've got Darren Hunt with me now and going into our second year together hunting. And he keeps hearing about all these stories of the previous years, you know, 4 and 5 coyotes at a time barreling in on the collar, and, you know, things getting Western quick and guns going off and, you know, putting 6, 7, 8 coyotes on the rack at night. And now, you know, if we're lucky to kill 1 or 2, we've had a good night, and he's not seeing that kind of stuff. And I'm almost thinking, Kevin, that it's with the use of thermals and over time, you know, like in this area, I'll throw this in real quick. In this area, like Brad and I have hunted for years, and now Darren, and then there's some other guys in this general area. There's probably been, I know Brad and I killed over 500 together, and I would say there's probably been 1,000 coyotes in a 3-4 county area that I know of from hunters killed over the last 4 or 5 years. So my philosophy or thinking is, we've killed so many of the aggressive ones that have came to callers, and the only thing left that's breeding and producing are those timid shire coyotes. Or are they breeding that into them? You know, I'm wondering, I'm questioning myself as I'm learning, you know, because I'm still learning at coyote hunting. You know, it's a never ending learning process because it's always changing. And what I'm saying now compared 4 years ago, it's calling here locally is way different. And that's what I've been telling Darren. I said, I think, you know, I don't know, I'm not a biologist, but it's almost like we're killing the aggressiveness out of them and leaving all the timid shire coyotes to breed. And is that trait carried on through them? Because, you know, it's a lot harder to kill coyotes here now than what it was just 3 years ago, even.
Right. Well, I know that's one thing I think Don even talked about in his book a little bit is, and I've heard other people mention it too, they figure the last things left on the earth are going to be coyotes and cockroaches. And yeah. I know Don talked about in his book about all the different ways that not only people like you and me, but the government has tried to eliminate coyotes all over the country, and they haven't been successful. So, you know, they're adaptive animals for sure. So who knows what level that adaptiveness goes to?
I know. It's, you know, yourself, have you seen a farm that you've hunted over the years that you've killed, you know, you first started hunting and you were killing coyotes on it, and then it just kind of goes away? You struggle to kill a coyote on that property. They're there. They're still there.
Right. There's one place in particular I have that's been like that. I have a video here from, I think it was 3-4 years ago, where I called in like 5 at once. And yeah, I only managed to whack one of them, but for, you know, a couple of years there, that place was money. I mean, there's always activity around there. You'd find fawn legs and deer parts and whatever, and you could always count on some sort of activity, even if it was just vocalizations or if it was, you know, calling them in. But, you know, like this year, and I bet you probably half of last year, if I did see one, they were staying way out, or lately it's been no activity at all. Now, is it a question of they've moved to a different area? They're just not coming there for one reason or another. I don't know. But, you know, there's one thing I've noticed too. On some properties, let's say you have two adjoining properties. On the one property, you can have all kinds of activity. But if you go right to the next property on the other side of it, you might not have any. And that's something that I've found that's kind of odd. And this property I'm talking about is like that. On this side of the property, the activity dropped way off. But if I go to the next property over and hunt it from the opposite direction, it's still sporadic, but I'm more likely to see something over there. It's just kind of weird how that works.
That is one thing I've learned off of the kennel coyotes. They get so secure within their environment that I can go out and open the kennel door and they won't come out.
Really?
You would think they'd just shoot right out, but right. They won't. They'll walk up and they kind of stick their head out and they look around. It's a big world out there. They don't know it, and they won't leave that kennel, and they're secure within that, in their kennel.
They get three hots in a cot.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, that's got to be a correlation with the wild coyotes. They get in their environment, their territory, they're secure, and it's hard to get them out of it.
Right.
And that's like with us calling, especially the daytime coyotes. It's a lot different in the daytime than it is at night, getting them to break that comfort zone and commit and come into a call in the daytime than it is at night. You know, they're already active. They're already roaming. So it's a lot easier to get them to commit.
So do you think with all the added pressure at night in some areas, obviously it's not everywhere, but in some areas, all the added pressure at night with the thermal hunters, do you think daytime would be more productive possibly?
Might. I haven't. I'll say this. 2 years ago in the wintertime, I did do a lot of daytime calling in the winter with snow on, and called six coyotes in 1 week with shotgun. Could I have done that 15 years ago? Probably not. So it could, but I haven't stuck with it, mainly because, man, you're a lot of time, a lot of gas, and a lot of walking daytime calling. Yeah. You know, and it's just your A-plus game for daytime calling to be successful. Nighttime, you can get away with a heck of a lot more, of a lot less walking, and be more successful. So it's hard to leave that. Right. I'm not going to lie. It's hard to leave that and go back to day.
Yep. And that's one thing that I know I've in particular told people, if you want to be a better hunter overall, try to learn to be good during the day. If you can learn to be good during the day, at night, it's gravy.
Yeah. Yep. And, exactly.
You know, that's how I started off initially. It was daytime. And then we gradually broke into night, starting off with lights, and, you know, then went from lights to night vision, and now, you know, thermal. So, I mean, we've evolved over the time that we've been hunting, but I mean, I still like to go out and call during the day, and every year I whack a few that way and I enjoy it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The hard thing for me, and I know a few other guys too, is just getting the time to do it during the day with work and family and everything else. Sometimes it's just, you have more time available after dark.
Exactly.
You know?
Yep. And it's, and they're already up and active and moving, and just the success rate's way higher at night with less effort.
Right. Know. More money, but less effort.
Yeah. I mean, I'd never dreamed, you know, back when I was calling in daytime, that I could go out at night and stand in a wide open field, standing up, and have coyotes run in within feet of me in the dark.
Yep. You know? It's funny because as we've transitioned through years, I remember the first time that Josh and I heard someone talking about standing in the middle of a field and calling, and we're like, we'd never do that. That ain't gonna work. now look at us. That's exactly what we're doing.
I know. It goes against everything you've learned daytime.
Yep.
I mean, it goes totally against it. Yep. Yeah. And even when I started at night, I was using structure, fence rows, wood lines to back up against, thinking I had, still standing up. And that was still, going through that learning. How many times have you been standing with your back up against the woods, calling out into a big open field, and you howl and wait, and one howl's like 20 feet behind you in the dark, and you about piss down your leg. Right. And it's like, okay, we need to actually get away from this, because they're using that cover to come in. Mm-hmm. And we wasn't seeing them and getting busted. So getting busted's educating.
Yep.
We start moving off those edges and still killing coyotes. And it's like, they're running right up to us in the dark. So why the hell are we trying to hide so hard?
Right.
And now it's to the point, park the truck, walk 50 yards away from the truck and kill coyotes.
Yep.
I never dreamed it 20 right. years ago. Never dreamed being able to do that.
Right.
But we're doing it.
Yep. So let's get into talking a little bit about tactics and such. Let's start off with, let's say, like where we are right now in terms of, the coyote's life cycle, the time of year and everything. Do your tactics change much from, other times of the year to like now?
Honest to God, no. I don't change what I do throughout the year. Mm-hmm. I really don't. I kill with the same sounds in early fall and late summer as I do this time of year. The only tactic I'll change now is, before I wouldn't do, would maybe pick up my stuff and go to them when they're howling and they won't break and come in.
Mm-hmm.
Because for whatever reason, whether they're educated or what the deal is, but now I'm trying to put coyotes in a truck, whereas before I always leave them for another day.
Mm-hmm.
But now the next day they do the same thing. So now I'm starting to move in on them, leave the collar sit where it was, keep that sound going, and then move in on them to try and get them killed. But as far as, the only time I change any tactic is in the springtime when the whitetails are dropping fawns. I will run a fawn distress and mix in a lot of coyote vocals with that fawn. That's really the only tactic change that I do, by adding that two sounds of coyote and the fawn. And it's usually pretty productive
if you don't get run over by a deer in the process.
Yeah, exactly. You gotta watch your ass, because right. them does come in fired up.
Yeah,
but that adds to that stand,
right?
Getting them does stomping and snorting and that coyote and the fawn, and it's pretty productive strategy.
So do you focus more on vocals in general, would you say? Or do you still mix in a fair amount of distress?
I'm mostly vocals, because I like the aggressive coyotes stands. And not that I don't like shooting a single coyote that comes in slow to a rabbit distress, but I like the hard charging three or four coyotes coming to a fight. So with that said, I do a lot with vocals, but if it's not working, I'm going to play prey distress.
Okay.
And that's something I try and, I'm sure you do too. You get asked all the time, what sounds do you play? What do you start with? Do you start with a howl? Do you start with this? I always explain, it's like fishing, trying to find what color the fish are biting on that day is the same as with coyote calling. What sounds are they biting on that night?
Yep.
I've seen going out at night and play rabbit distress to start the stand for those close ones, that might be in a waterway that are out of sight, that, may pop up and come right in, to starting stands with a howl to starting stands just straight off with a coyote fight and see what they bite on. And if whatever works, I stick with it until it quits working. And it's funny how when I get into a certain area, the same thing will work for a while and, you know, and then just quit.
Yeah, it's like somebody
else switch. Yeah. And I'll switch to, okay, say I started off with two different howls and coyotes were coming in to those howls and then they quit, you start off a stand with a rabbit, kill coyote, keep doing it. Yeah. It's just so funny how they are when it comes to that. So that's, you know, everybody out there that's wanting to know what sound and how do I play the sound and how long do I play it for and all that, there's no set rule. It's just you're fishing, basically.
And that's a question you see all the time, and that's my answer to those guys is the same thing. I honestly can't tell you because I change it up so much.
Exactly.
You know, if I find something, like you said, if you find something particular that's working, you run it until it stops working, then you switch to something else. And not only that, but again, going back to kind of pressured areas, every set I do is different, you know, in terms of what I start with, what volume I start with. You know, a lot of it to me, up here where I'm at, I don't have a lot of real big open areas. So most of my stuff is smaller fields. There's a few agricultural fields, but even where I'm at, they aren't real big. So a lot of times I'm starting off with something low volume, maybe a little bit of stress to start off. But then after that, it's, you know, whatever sounds good. But again, I'm switching it up all the time too.
Yeah, exactly.
So, I mean, it's hard for me to answer that question because I don't think there is in particular any one thing that other than starting with a low volume distress for a couple minutes. I do that on most of my sets, but I change that up too. I might run cat. I might run rabbit. I might run vole. I might run, you know, bird. You know, I'll switch that up a lot too, but in general, I start with low volume distress to start. And then from there, who knows what I'm going to go to, whatever flips my switch until I find what's working.
Exactly. And there's some nights that ain't nothing working.
Nothing's
going to
work, right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah. And that's something I've, you know, showed Darren as well. I don't know about Michigan, but here where I'm at, 1 o'clock in the morning seems to be the hour, whether it's the turn off hour or turn on hour. Whereas, you know, starting at dark, and they're active, if they're real active early on, I can almost count on 1 o'clock being they're done.
Mm-hmm. And there's some nights where they're active all night long. My buddy Jeremy and I won one of our tournaments here back in 2018. We started at, and this is of course end of January, I think it was. We started at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. First one, we called in a double, shotgunned them. And then every night or every set that night, we had action and killed on until daylight. And I mean, that's the only time we've ever had that happen. But I mean, it was just,
hold them, huh?
Just nonstop. And it was one of those nights too, where, you know, we started off with den raid. And that's what called in that double that we shotgun. And almost every set that night, den raid is what brought them in. Mm-hmm. It's just, you know, it's crazy how that works sometimes. And there's been other nights where you go all night and you don't see a damn thing.
I know. Those are frustrating.
Right.
But that's like my wife, you know, I'll go out or I'll get ready to leave and go out. I'll be back in a couple hours, you know, and leave at 8 o'clock and you're back at 3:30 in the morning, right. A couple hours. Well, it's just like fishing, one more cast,
right.
One more stand. Man. It's going to happen this next stand. I got a good spot. I'm going to hit it.
Yeah.
I'm going to kill.
I'll go tell my wife that, I'm just going to go out and do one set. And she looks at me, kind of rolls her eyes. She goes, I know how one set works.
Exactly.
And the next, nothing's happening. Those one sets, sometimes that'll hold true, but not very often, especially if I'm getting activity. Well, let me give you a couple of scenarios and you can tell me what your approach to it may be. Let's say you're calling a spot, you get vocalizations, you vocalize back, they vocalize back, but they don't seem to want to budge from that area. What is your strategy in that situation?
First thing I'll try and determine is what did they say back to me? I feed off of those vocals back. And if they're just vocalizing the normal yipping and howling and carrying on versus one or two in that group that are really throaty, really deep, got some attitude to them, those coyotes, I stay put because I'll get them. Eventually, I will piss them off enough to the point that they're going to come in. And that, you know, I had that just last night. If I've got, you know, a group that answers me, I'm going to try and determine what it was they said to me. A normal yipping, just response back. If they're close, I'll stay put and try and find a sound that, you know, one will bite on and come in. If they are at a distance and I got a position that I can move on them and get a little closer, then I'm going to do that. And hopefully piss them off. My end goal is to piss them off because a pissed off coyote's a dead coyote in my eyes. But if they respond back to me that initial howl, and I know there's a mad one in there or two, I stay put because I've seen them come from a long ways off on a dead run when you get them mad. If I run into that situation where I got one or two pissed, I stick strictly to vocals. Okay. And I'll start off with like subtle type coyote vocalizations. And I did that video and everybody's like, what's a subtle type sound? A subtle type sound to me has some yips, some squeaks, not much distress, not a whole lot, you know, going on in there. It's just basically disturbed, I guess, would be a way to put it.
Like social,
you know, no squalling, huh?
Like social vocals?
Not necessarily social. I've got a sound which you can listen to a preview sample of it on our website, the Icotech website, and it's called Coyote Whines. Mm-hmm. And that is, I mean, I've killed a boatload of coyotes on that sound when I get them to vocalize back to me. And I've got one or two in there that's got an attitude. That coyote whines has a lot of yipping, some squeaking, not necessarily an all-out distress type sound. And like I said, that one I usually go to first. After they've a lot, you know, I let them do their thing. I let things calm down for a little bit. Then I start that sound. And like you said with den raid, you know, you've killed a lot. That's usually, you know, they're coming running in because of that. If that first coyote whines doesn't get them, then I build up intensity through my sounds with more aggressive sounds. You know, next one might go to, like, I've got a sound called Pup Frenzy. That's where they're just chattering, and then two females at the end get into a fight. A lot of squealing, growling, yipping. That doesn't get them. Then I go into, you know, just knock down, drag out, fight. Whether it's something like den raid, I've got one I use called uppercut. Pretty similar. A lot of growling, a lot of squalling. Those, out of those three sounds, usually, you know, got them on a coming in. Okay. So now I'm working with a sound that, like the one I used last night, just it's basically called Coyote Fight that I recorded and put together. And it this year has been working pretty doggone good. So, but
so then
non-aggressive coyotes, you know, move in on them, try to stress first.
Okay. Okay, here's the next situation. Let's say you're out, you have a group vocalizing over here, a group vocalizing over here. Do you have a particular strategy when you're in between two groups?
How far are they? are they close or are they, if they're within a quarter mile, half mile of me, I just stay put and hope, you know, one of them comes in. And I have seen that situation where I've on with a road, you know, there was a pair behind me and a pair in front of me. Neither of them would come to me. whether I was on that line or what it was, but I ended up moving around on the pair that was in front of me because of the wind direction was the better option, and ended up killing one of those two by just moving around the block and coming at them from a different angle. Okay. So yeah, I guess if I'm stuck to where I'm at and I've got coyotes on both sides of me howling, I try and piss off one. Cause if you got a group of coyotes in the woods and they're howling, you piss one of those coyotes off and that one coyote comes in, he commits. The rest of them are coming with him. Mm-hmm. Or maybe not all of them, but a couple of them are going to come with him. So usually.
How often or if ever do you use like challenge howls?
Never.
Never?
Okay. Really? Only time I ever use a challenge howl would be last ditch effort in my eyes. I've never used it. Okay. Now out west I've used it. He had a challenge that I would use out west. I wish I could remember the name of it, but I can't now. It's been so long since I've used it, but yeah, here at night I don't use challenge house.
Okay.
Just good.
That's something I don't use very often either. I've used it like a handful of times, and usually I'll use it in response to if I was challenged by one. I'll respond back with a challenge, and I've had that work really well. But overall, in general, no, I don't use them.
Now, if I get challenged by one, I always carry my howler in my pocket. I'll get back at him with that. But as far as playing one on a collar, I never really play them.
Okay. Fair enough.
It's like that one last night, you know, it was challenging 300 yards just out of sight in the wood line, wouldn't break. And he was pissed and just challenging and nonstop. And it just flat coyote fight. Here he came.
Nice.
Yeah.
So then let's go into like the physical parts of when you go out calling. Are there any conditions in particular that you look for, or any particular conditions other than, you know, heavy rain and wind that you decide, nah, I'm not even going to go out?
Heavy rain and wind.
Right.
Yep. Or snowing. If it's snowing, I'm not. Any other time, full moon, no matter what the moon, I'm hunting. If it's, you know, fit. I used to love the colder, the better. Mm. Not anymore. Not anymore. It's weird how, you know, I always thought colder, the better, fresh snowfall, great conditions. No, it's not. Yeah, it's all in our head. It's usually about 3 days after that before they start getting active, because it shocks them just as it does us. You know, they don't want to be out in that crap either. So They got to be. But any other time I'm hunting.
Now, do you prefer a crosswind? What kind of wind do you prefer? And is there a maximum speed that you'll hunt in? maximum wind?
Daytime, I won't hunt in anything above 15 mile an hour winds.
Okay.
And it's, yes, crosswind. I mean, daytime, I'm strict on following all the rules. Nighttime, a good 10 mile an hour plus wind usually is not comfortable for us to be hunting in, but better conditions for success because
yep.
they've got the wind to work with when they're approaching the sounds. And with those kind of winds, I can push the envelope, you know, with places I can call, you know, wind's just not absolutely perfect. You know, I've got more options by being able to be out in the wide open.
Right.
To adjust my scent cone to make it work. Whereas daytime, your options are limited to where you can set up. So you've really got to adhere to that scent cone and not getting busted.
Mm.
So that's another nice thing of night calling. You know, you can get by with calling a section with a less than desirable wind and still be successful.
Okay. What about nights where there's like no wind?
They're fun to hunt in, but they're not as productive.
Right.
You know, because it's usually not as cold.
Right.
And you can communicate with somebody if you're hunting with somebody, but you know, for whatever reason, they're not that active and they're not that when it's dead calm.
When it's calm like that too, in my experience, I've seen it almost like if it's really calm, it's almost like your scent disperses more. And I think if they get closer, you know, let's say they're coming through cover, I think that there's more of a likelihood of them catching your wind,
picking.
Even yeah. if it's, you know, down to nothing. I just think it disperses more.
That, and it's so variable at right. that point.
Yeah, with thermals yeah. and everything else.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if you're well, hunting ground bitter. That's hilly, you know, anyone that's hunted thermals knows how that works. You know, stuff settles yeah. in the low ground and you might think your wind's out of the north, even if it's 1 mile per hour, but man, they hit that low ground and like gone.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
Let's say you walk into a set and this is actually brought up by one of our other guests the other day. They didn't scan as they walked into the field, which was probably mistake number one, but they get in, they set up, and as soon as they let loose with a howl, one's howling like within 100 yards in the wood line. So we figured or assumed that, you know, you probably busted him he busted you as you walked out. Would you have a strategy for trying to call that one at that point, assuming you kicked it out of that field as you approached, or would you just hang it up and come back another time?
Pup frenzy.
Pup frenzy?
Straight to pup frenzy. Yes. Okay. I've seen quite a few of them die after, you know, running them out. And you know by the way they're acting that you ran them out, that they know you're there.
Mm-hmm.
Pup frenzy has killed coyotes in that situation for me.
Okay.
Not always, but it has.
Mm-hmm.
And I always try it. If it don't work, it's 5 minutes tops. If it don't get them to come out, then I just quietly get the heck out of there and come back another day. But I've seen several come shooting out of there once that end of that sound starts squalling.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of which, how long would you say your average set is?
Some people that hunt with me say are too long because I'll give them plenty of time to, you know, eventually work in, but anywhere from 15 to 45 minutes. I mean, okay. Hell, I've been some places I've waited an hour because I knew that they were there.
Right.
Just get, yeah. You know, how many times I've seen coyotes and they give you absolutely no attention whatsoever. You run through 5-6 sounds and they just act like you don't exist, and then next thing you know they can't get to you fast enough. And I always envision that, you know, whether I can see one out there or not, I can always, that's what keeps me on that stand that little bit longer, like any second, one's just going to come around and end the sight. Keep telling myself that, but sometimes they do, and most times they don't. But
yeah, that's up here. We usually give about half an hour. Like I tell people, I said it may be shorter if it's one of those stands where I don't see anything, I don't hear anything, and a lot of it probably is self-confidence that like that just doesn't feel right. I might cut it short at like 15 minutes. Other spots, you know, where I feel like there's got to be a coyote around here, I'll give it like half an hour, and then if I get some sort of response or if I see one, then definitely I'm willing to sit. I think I've been on set some places, you know, like you said, an hour or better, because I knew they were there and I could watch them or I could hear them and I just kept working them. And I've killed them at that point too, probably same as you have. And there's other times too where I spent that time and watched them just keep on going. It's
like this. Yeah. And how many times have you visually watch the ones you're calling to that are like giving you the cold shoulder, and another one or two come running in from behind direction. And where the hell they come from, you have no idea, but they showed up.
I've had that happen several times. Matter of fact, one was pretty memorable. I want to say it was last year. It was actually a horse pasture that the guy has trouble with coyotes at. And I'm watching this coyote out in front of me, and it's like you said, it was pretty much ignoring me. It was paralleling me, and all of a sudden I hear something running behind me. I turn around, look, and like you said, this coyote's just hauling butt right towards me, and it actually kind of startled me, but I turn around, he turned around, ran off same time, and I got him just as he got to the wood line. But yeah, it's just, I didn't expect him to come from there, and I'm so focused on watching this one that, you know, I heard him run up on me. Pretty crazy.
Exactly. And that's where those fight sounds. I see that out of fight and distress pup, you know, coyotes distresses and things of that nature. Mm-hmm. Not often do I have that happen with prey distresses, you know, one come from out of nowhere like that on me. But yeah, those are always a surprise. Sure.
What all states have you hunted in?
Oh, Montana, Arizona, New Mexico, Kentucky, New York, Pennsylvania, or not New York, that was Turkey, Pennsylvania, Indiana, Texas, and getting ready to go down and try Florida.
Really?
Yeah.
Very cool. So then do you feel this is always a big debate too. Is there a difference between Western coyotes versus Eastern coyotes in your opinion?
Yeah. For sure. They're Western coyotes is about like us in the East using thermals at night. Comparative. Western coyotes will howl all day long. I mean, you can go out there at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, 100 degrees, and howl and hear multiple packs start lighting up and howling, you know, just like if you did here in the East at night. Mm-hmm. Daytime here in the East, they're not howling like that.
That's what I tell people too all the time. I mean, very rarely do you hear a vocalization in the daytime.
Yeah. I can count on one hand how many times I've, you know, actually got coyotes to howl back to me in the daytime here in the East. Mm-hmm. Over 25 years of hunting them and doing it out there. It's just, it's normal,
right?
You know, and out there, you know, I don't care what they say. It's easier to kill a coyote in the daytime out West than it is in the East by far. Mm. So, but us having thermals and hunting them at night is, you know, we can put up
kind of equalizing the playing field.
Yeah, it does. Then we got bigger coyotes here.
I agree with that.
Structured coyotes. The 223, how that you see that online, you know. Out West, the 223 kills coyotes. Here, I've learned it's almost not big enough gun. because our coyotes are bigger structured. They're thicker hides, more muscle mass. And hell, even in the winter, they put on a layer of fat.
Yeah.
So all that stuff stacks up. And, you know, a Western coyote, smaller frame, thinner hide, you know, they're 223 works just fine out there. But here, see plenty of them run off from them.
We just had a discussion with that on one of the pages here not too long ago. They were talking about weights of coyotes. And I know I was talking to one of the guys, and they were asking, you know, what's the biggest one you've got? And I didn't shoot it, but I was with a guy that we shot one that when we weighed it in the field, it was just over 50 pounds. When we weighed it in officially for the tournament, it was like 49 and change. I think the biggest one I've personally shot was like 47, 48. And he says, man, he says, we're lucky to see one that tops 30 pounds out here.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've been keeping a log since like 2017. And I want to say I averaged it out a year or two ago. And I think the average weight for a female around here that I've taken was like 26 pounds. And the average male was like 27, 28, 30 pounds, somewhere in there, with quite a few above that and not as many below that. The smallest coyote that wasn't a pup that I've shot was in, it was October, and I shot one in our Upper Peninsula that only weighed in at like just over 11 pounds.
Holy wow.
Yeah, that's the smallest coyote that wasn't a pup I've ever shot. So, yeah, I agree with that. And I think from what I've heard, they're even bigger further north you go to, like Canada.
Yeah. Yeah.
I haven't been up there yet, though.
No, me neither. I'd love to go after a wolf up there, though.
You and me both. I made it out for our one wolf season we had here in Michigan. And I would love to do it again if they would get rid of these damn federal protection on them. But that's one of my bucket list items is a wolf and a black coyote.
Yeah, and same here.
You haven't seen any down there?
Nope. Not really? Well, yeah, one.
Okay.
I've seen one here. Brad and I were hunting one night, and he had night vision. I had thermal. We got out of the truck. I started scanning. There's something. We're within 200 yards of a house where we had parked, and this was across the road, and it was on property we could hunt, and it was laying there in the field. And I told Brad, he was getting his stuff out. I said, there's something right here across the road, 150 yards. Looks like a dog of some kind. And I don't know what it is. We were hunting a contest at the time. And so he gets his stuff out. He turns his night vision on. He's like, oh, it's black. Okay. It's like, it must be this dog or something from this house right here by us. So long story short, I keep watching it. We get all the stuff out and it stands up. I'm like, eh. I said, Brad, look at that again. He looks at it, he's like, dude, it's black as night. So I just kind of, I hollered at it. I can't remember what I hollered, but it took off coyote lope. Loping away. It's like, son of a, it was a coyote.
Well,
but you know, we decided on caution, didn't shoot it because we didn't know what it was. So.
Right.
But it ended up being a black coyote.
I've seen one black one and I missed it three times. And a month after that, somebody else just was driving along, seen it, got out and shot it.
But oh, shit.
Really? That particular area, I know there's been, I want to say at least two or three black coyotes taken off that particular area. But I have yet to see another one since that first one. That's, wow. But I know they're around. I think there's more. It seems like the further south you go, the more color variation you get too.
Yeah. Yeah. Heck, in the Carolinas, them guys are shooting black coyotes. Yeah. It's just like, it's any old coyote, you know?
Yeah.
I'm like dying to walk up on one in the dark, you know, black.
Well, they're all black and black out on thermal, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I did see a snow white coyote one time in the LBL in Kentucky. Yeah, we were daytime calling, and that was in 2005. I was hunting with Brent Saxton, and he was hand calling. I kind of looked back over my shoulder, and I seen this white dog coming across this kind of open area. And that's the first thing I thought, dog, because I've never seen a coyote that white.
Nope.
And then as it's coming through, and I'm thinking, they're in a house for miles, you know, where we were at in the LBL. And it gets to about 200 yards, and it's in the timber, and I start scoping, and I'm like, holy crap, that's a coyote. And that ended up getting our wind and shooting up the side of a hill there through the timber. Nope, never did get a shot at the thing, but seeing it was pretty neat. Yeah, I'd love to have gotten it.
There was one taken here in Michigan by a guy, Edgar Kinsley. He shot one. This has been several years ago now, but I remember when he shot it, and that sucker was all white, beautiful. He got a mount done of it, but I've never seen one that light. I mean, I got a nice blonde over here on the wall that's a two-pointer. That's probably the prettiest colored one that I've gotten, but I've never seen a white one for sure.
Yeah, I've only seen that one.
Now, are you still seeing many fox or no?
We're starting to see more fox.
Are you?
Actually, I've called more fox in the last couple of weeks than I have coyotes.
All reds so, yet?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, reds. I actually got a trail camera picture of a gray fox, which is the first I've seen a gray fox around here. And I think I was thinking it's got to be 15 to 18 years. You know, I trapped one of the last ones I trapped was that long ago.
Oh, wow.
But yeah, I got a trail camera picture of one this past fall.
What's your season for them down there?
November to end of January, like Boy, that's November 10th. Season.
Holy cow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now,
yeah. And, which I don't even shoot them. I don't shoot reds or grays, obviously.
Have you guys seen any bobcats down there?
No. Yeah, no. Eastern part of the state, we've called them in. Here, we've called in a couple things that we're like, is that a bobcat? You know, with thermal, can't really fully tell right. What it was, but we were pretty sure it was a bobcat. But they, off in the distance, just the way they acted, yeah. Sit down, did a lot of sitting down and looking versus running in.
Right.
So.
Very cool. All right. Well, thank you very much. I think we'll cut it off for the night. I appreciate you taking your time and sharing your knowledge with us.
Yeah, hopefully it can help. Right. Hopefully helps.
So anyone listening, if you want to check him out, just look up JD on Facebook or Predator Academy, and then also Predator Academy on YouTube. Are there any other outlets to look you up or your show?
That's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah, Facebook and YouTube.
And I've watched several episodes, like I said, of the Predator Academy. There's some really good information in there, even on setting up guns and then call setup, stand selection, and running the set. So check it out when you get a chance. Well, thank you very much, JD.
Hey, it's been a pleasure. And thank you.
Everybody have a good night, and thanks for listening.